It's the last pure on the final day, and that'll be open notes too. So really, you could take each of these, you could take these sheets, get your textbook and get the website, and just write up anything you want to, and have, you could be all ready for the test before you come in next time without even hearing the last material. I want to reissue the warning, the caveat, that if you don't learn your material, just bring in a stack of paper. It's frustrating to watch people dig and dig and dig and finally come up and beg me, where was this, where was that? So do actually, if you don't memorize the facts, at least memorize where in the sheets the facts are. What's the week from today, right? Today's Thursday. A week from today, same time. They say a lot, 2 hours for the final, but it's going to be the same length as every other test, so it shouldn't take you more than normal unless you spend more time looking for things. Oh, yeah, but you surely won't need it unless you don't memorize your material. Okay, so we pick up on the sheet on item 30. 30 is... Before we get to 30, let me go back to 29 and reiterate something you need to know. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, sponsored by Stephen Douglas of Illinois. This is a repeat, but I think it'll make things clear again for us. Douglas's purpose was to try to make his state prominent, making thus himself to be a prominent politician. Speaking of prominent politicians, who's the leading Republican contender for the presidency now? A boy from Hope, Huckabee. And it's not just Iowa, but it's also New Hampshire, too. So who knows what things will turn out. So Stephen Douglas, I guess, must have at one point felt the same thing the early Huckabee campaign is, how can I make myself prominent? Well, the way he went after it, Douglas went to make himself prominent, was to try to get the first transcontinental railroad to connect through Chicago. And to do that, he wanted to drop the ban on slavery in the Louisiana Territory so that Southerners would vote for the railroad construction through that area. And to do so, he formulated the concept of new territories, Kansas and Nebraska. Dropping the ban on the slavery in the area, he hoped to sell Kansas as a potential slave state and Nebraska as a potential free state, which would bring one more of each in, keeping a balance in Congress, opening all that area for his railroad, and then Chicago becomes prominent, he becomes a presidential candidate. He didn't anticipate what followed instead, and that is the destruction of the Whig Party. The Whigs, who had been so careful of, at the end of their party in the early 1850s to avoid the slavery issue because they had pro and anti-slavery people in their party, could not avoid the divisive effects of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So the party split and disintegrated. And within that same year of 1854, loose elements, political elements, coalesce and create the Republican Party of today. They included the anti-slavery conscious Whigs, the Free Soil Third Party movement, and then members of the Democratic Party that had opposed the Kansas-Nebraska Act on the anti-slavery issue, calling themselves anti-Nebraska Democrats. Within the next 2 to 4 years, Whigs who were business Whigs, Eastern Seaboard business Whigs who wanted high tariffs and road building and banks, etc., would eventually join this party. Item 30, another political party that's created around the same time, it comes into being between 1853 and 1856, is known as the Know-Nothing Party. They start out as a fraternal order called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. But in time, moved from just being a fraternal order to being a third-party faction, political party. Usually they called themselves the American Party. They never called themselves the Know-Nothing Party. That was a derisive label that others gave to them. And the reason why is because of the main issue upon which they campaigned. They were a one-issue party. And that issue was they were against Catholic European immigrants, be they German or Irish, especially the Irish. They opposed Catholic immigrants from Europe. And we did not spend time talking much about 1 through 11. Had we, it would have made a little more sense of why. But almost all the Irish who came into the United States were Catholic background, and probably half the Germans were Catholic too. Now, Germans are of same economic, same ethnic background as Anglo-Saxons, but Irish of Celtic background were perceived then as being inferior people. So you've got racially inferior as well as Catholic. That's why the big, bugaboo, if you want to use that expression, against the Irish was whooped up all the time. And, yes?
Okay, can you say
then when they became a political party, not just a fraternal order, they called themselves the American Party. But in textbooks and in slang and colloquial, they're often called the Know-Nothing, and we'll explain why in a minute, why they got that name. But I want to come back and focus on their main complaints were anti-Catholic and especially anti-foreign Catholic. Anti-Catholicism was something that had been strong in America from the earliest colonial days. Why? Because the Church of England represented patriotic being a real English person, and Catholicism represented the Latin, Spanish, French, Italian, other parts of non-English. You just weren't a good English subject if you were a Catholic. You were suspect. And that carried over into the American colonies. With it also was not just anti-religion, but there's a lot of unspoken ethnic stuff going on there in terms of Anglo-Saxon Germanic people feeling themselves to be superior to Romance language nations such as Portugal, Spain, France that were more of a Latin background. And the anti-Catholic feeling that's strong in America in the early years really lasts well into the 20th century. Now, the Democratic Party did recruit a lot of Catholic voters, no doubt. Most immigrants in the cities were Catholic voters. But when the first time they tried to run a presidential candidate, first Catholic, was in 1928. Anybody know who? It was Al Smith of New York, a party boss from New York City. And because of his Catholic heritage, the South deserted him that year, went off and voted instead for Herbert Hoover, and he lost. And there wouldn't be an even though he had a running mate from Arkansas, Joe Robinson. Like actually helped, I guess. And then who was the next Catholic candidate to run? JFK. And then before he ran and won, he had to make a speech where? Anybody know this? It was Houston. It's in Texas for sure. And to whom did he have to make his explanation speech? Baptist ministers, in which he said, although I happen to be a Catholic, I follow the Constitution, not the papacy. I'm not a tool of the papacy. I don't represent my church. I just represent the United States, who happens to be a Catholic. And quite historic, because what happened today? Yes, Mitt Romney, another Massachusetts politician, had to make his statement, or felt he had to make his statement today, to clarify that although he is a Mormon, he'd follow the Constitution, not be following the church first. So in many ways, they thought he needed to make this same speech to clear the field and keep people on board in the conservative movement, just like Kennedy had to in order to keep Southerners on board at that time. So it's an apt historic comparison and parallel. So you can see here that anti-Catholicism was strong. And what was, aside from the ethnic issues, and I guess aside from the theological issues, what was the big scare about Catholics? Yes. Therefore, I'd say all the way up until the Kennedy thing in 1960, there was always this kind of feeling like they're sleeper cell Al-Qaeda agents waiting for the Pope to give them marching orders. They act American, but they're really always loyalties first to the church. That was the feeling that existed. And that explains the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner American Party. Now, when asked, is it true that you guys hate Catholics because you think most of them, the Irish, are racially inferior, you're just an anti-immigrant, anti-racist, anti-Catholic party, they'd say, that's unfair labeling. We know nothing about that. All we know is that we want people who understand the Constitution and understand liberty and democracy rather than dictatorship. Of course, what they're doing is euphemizing what they really mean. So to not know anything about the criticism is how the expression, you must be know-nothings, came about. They ran for some congressional seats and did win some congressional seats in the 1852 and 54 election, and 56. In 1856, they even ran a presidential candidate, a former president, Millard Fillmore. Now, when asked after the fact, Millard, is it true that you offered your name up for a anti-immigrant racist party? He said, I know nothing about that. I was always a Whig. or physics. They just happen to nominate me also at the same time. So that's what's in item 30. But it tells you that with the short-lived Know-Nothing Party and the creation of the Republican Party and the dismantling of the Whig Party, there is a lot of political upheaval taking place, which is just a few years before secession and civil war. Just a little bit I want to say on 31 and beyond with it. This is another part of the effects of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. That being that, well, here's what Douglas thought. Now that we have the ban dropped on slavery and Southerners have voted to open up the territories for railroad building, that should be out of our hair for a long period of time. There's nobody wants to move out there in any hurry. It'll be decades before people settle there. Well, that's not the case at all. Right away, within the year 55 going into 1856, elements started to move in a hurry to eastern Kansas. Some of them were Southerners, some of them Missourians, who brought slaves with them and couldn't grow cotton, so they literally had to keep slaves alive just so they could be there and be owning slaves. Others came from New England, sponsored by the churches, sponsored by such preachers as Henry Ward Beecher, the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe. So lots of church donations went into sending Bibles and people and supplies and wagons and eventually rifles that were nicknamed Beecher's Bibles were sent to Kansas. And when you have people moving off into a barren, forsaken place, not really to be farmers, but to be politically in larger numbers than your opposition, what kind of attitudes are we thinking of here? Explosive, convulsive. So it's not surprising that by mid-1856, elements of one group would attack elements of the other, the example being here in item 32, where a group of pro-slavery Missourians attacked the city of Lawrence, which was populated by anti-slave people, pillaged, burned, looted, and killed. Pro-slavery Southerners attacked Lawrence, Kansas, which was a stronghold for free forces or anti-slavery forces. See, both groups are what they're trying to do is build up enough population so that they can become a state, and they hope to be in the majority and turn it into slave state or free state accordingly, according to popular sovereignty. This was not supposed to be the way popular sovereignty was supposed to work. It was supposed to be a gradual evolution of people who all are there because they want to live there rather than... It's almost kind of like, I don't know if you remember this or not, in the early 80s, there was a when we had all the abortion clinic bombings and murders of doctors going on, people from all over the United States moved to Wichita, Kansas, pro-abortion and anti-abortion, to get involved in protests and eventually violence in Wichita. And I thought, here it is, literally bleeding Kansas all over again on a different issue a century later. That's what was going on over the slavery issue here. Well, the raid on Lawrence kicked off a tumultuous week in May of 1856. There is the raid. In the middle of the week, item 33 takes place. So let's do 33 real quick and come back in to finishing 32. When news of the raid on Lawrence gets back east, a debate breaks out on the Senate floor. And Charles Sumner, in item 33, a Massachusetts politician, when he rose to speak about the violence that occurred in Lawrence earlier in the week, he began to slip into a southern pronunciation, southern accent, sarcastically. Then he began to slip into a southern accent with a speech impediment because he was targeting, is it Andrew Butler? Yeah, Andrew Butler was who he was making fun of, South Carolinian who had a speech impediment, and berated the South for saying that all they know how to do in order to achieve their ends is brutality. They beat their slaves, they beat their opponents in Kansas. Brutality seems to be the southern honor that we hear all about. And he ranted so far that even fellow Northerners got a bit embarrassed and tried to quiet him down and were not talking to him at the end of the day. Well, a couple of days later, Sumner, sitting at his Senate desk alone, writing, didn't hear, did not see that the nephew of Andrew Butler, Preston Brooks, who happened to be a House member from South Carolina, concerned about the insult to his uncle, Andrew Butler, Senator, crept up behind Sumner, pulled out a big long cane with a gold tip on it, and started beating him over the head. And Sumner tried to arise and get out of the way, and his legs got stuck on the desk and he fell over the ground, so Brooks just went over and kept beating him until he passed out. Nearly killed him. Nearly did. Within about half a year, Sumner recovered, but he stayed out of the Senate for 2 years, saying that's how bad his injuries were. So he kind of became the martyr at that point. So Brooks, the House member, caned Sumner, the senator, who had insulted Brooks's uncle, Butler. You don't have to get all the names straight. So what Sumner had said was true. That seems to be the way they handle the insults to honor, is by brutality. And Southerners who were proud of Butler standing up for their honor sent hundreds of canes to Washington in the mail to show their solidarity. And what would have been seen as just an insult and rudeness now came off as being a victim for Sumner. So the Brooks caning Sumner event becomes a real polarizing event. You know, we see these things when we're watching the legislature of Taiwan on TV. You don't see that in C-SPAN ever, kind of thing. But that used to, apparently from what I understand, is 19th century American politics had a lot of fistfights and canings and beatings going on. That's good. There's the smoother way of doing it. Do you remember the Cheney response to Metzenbaum? I don't think I can share it with everybody. Metzenbaum was making fun of Cheney and Halliburton, dropping a lot of wisecracks about suggesting that Cheney was purposely getting rich off the war in Iraq. And when the two saw each other on the Senate floor, Metzenbaum came over and tried to be friendly and smiled and put his hands out to shake, and Cheney told him to go F himself. And that was broadcast on TV. So that's a little easier than caning. Well, anyway, at the end of that week, having heard of the raid on Lawrence and the beating of Sumner, religious zealot / maybe fanatic John Brown of Kansas and his four sons decide that justice must be dealt out to these brutes who have attacked Lawrence and their ilk that beat up Sumner. So they search for where these people who raided Lawrence were hiding, found them asleep at Pottawatomie Creek, and in the night while they were asleep crept up and pulled out axes and split their heads open. So for the people who raided Lawrence. Yeah. So this is popular sovereignty at work in Kansas. I think that's what people had in mind, but that, and if what we're building a theme for here is that there was a point in time when Northerners and Southerners, regardless of what party they were in, were tolerant of each other's differences in lifestyle and property and economics. And then there is the growing abolitionist movement, which makes Southerners very guarded and very suspicious that the Northerners are out to take away their slaves. And they really are. I mean, that's exactly what the abolitionist movement's about. And one of the great arguments is that these issues, these problems, had always been compromised away before by politicians who were capable, like Clay and Webster and Douglas and others. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 or the Compromise of 1850 or the Tariff Compromise of 1833, these things found ways to resolve them. But in the mid-1850s, these politicians are retiring or dying. And the ones who are replacing them, both North and South, are real firebrands. They are real dedicated to free slaves, or they'll never get to take my slave away. And so emotionalism starts to replace compromise. And maybe, essentially, these kind of ethical issues can't forever just be compromised away. That might be the explanation. But when you reach a point where beatings and emotions replace compromise, it's inevitable that something's going to happen. And so a lot of historians think that, this is a popular school of thought, that the secession from the South from the Union was inevitable once those capable politicians had passed away and been replaced by firebrands. It was emotionalism replaced compromising. Then another school of thought says that secession was inevitable regardless of how many capable people you were, because it was just when struggle for power, push came to shove, that's what had to happen. But for sure, we're creeping towards this era, you know, emotional hotheadism and an irrepressible conflict between North and South. So skip 34 and move to 35, and what an important event this 35 is. Dred Scott was a slave whose owner lived in Missouri but was a member of the military, was stationed for a while in Illinois and then posted after that up in Minnesota. Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Federal military. Sent to an army post in Illinois and then later moved on up to an army post in Minnesota. Now, in the army post in Illinois is on federal territory within a free state, but Minnesota in the early 1850s, this shows 58 Kent State, so what's true about Minnesota in the early 1850s? It's still a territory and it's got a growing population, obviously it's going to become a state. But as a territory, what is the status of slavery?
It's not a slave state.
No, it's not a slave state? Well, let's think for a second. Has it been banned or has it been made legal?
It's both.
Here's both. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 banned it. But the Kansas-Nebraska Act reversed the ban to popular sovereignty. Can a law override a law? Excellent question. In terms of who determines which laws are laws, courts do, not future colonies. If you have conflicting laws on the books, it has to come to the courts. Abolitionists were the ones behind the challenge here. They said, once Dred Scott, the Scott story, his owner moved back to Missouri, retired, then passed away, bringing Dred Scott with him back on the whole triangular journey. Dred Scott became the property of the wife, whose brother in New York, you don't have to write all this far down, his brother in New York was an abolitionist. And the brother convinced the wife, sell me Dred Scott, and because I'll own him across state lines, that would make any suit for freedom be a federal case. And what we're going to do is have him sue me on the grounds that he's no longer a slave once he resided in Minnesota. Since slavery was banned in Minnesota, he couldn't have been a slave in Minnesota. He has to be free. So that's what's going on here. The abolitionists get a case in which they're going to try to get Dred Scott to sue his owner, the new owner, on the grounds that his residence in a free territory made him a free person. Well, the case goes through the federal courts, makes it to the Supreme Court. This is in 1857. Do you possibly recall, this was a bit of tidbit trivia, but do you recall who replaced the dying John Marshall in 1835 as Chief Justice? He was a man that was willing to move money into the Pett banks when the first two secretaries of the Treasury would not do so for Jackson. Roger Brooke Taney. Roger B. Taney, spelled T-A-N-E-Y. Taney moved the money to the Pett banks in 1835. His reward was appointment to the court after Marshall died in 35. And Taney would be Chief Justice from 1835 to 1864. He is a Catholic. He is the first Catholic Chief Justice on the court. So here we were talking about the Know Nothing Party, and there's someone there in that position. But he was an ardent slavery proponent and slave owner from Tennessee. The court had a majority of Southerners on it, who you'd naturally expect to be sympathetic to slavery. But these abolitionists thought they had a clear case. Regardless of the background of the judges, they would have to rule according to the law. Of course, there's two laws. So ruling could have been popular sovereignty suggests that whoever gets there first turns it into a slave state. But the argument they were going to carry was it wasn't a state yet. Once it became a slave state, yes. But as long as it wasn't a state yet, the Missouri law still applied. The ban was there. So they go to the court, and a decision is handed down, and the majority opinion is written by Taney. Taney, the Chief Justice, writes it. He's in the majority. And by the way, before I tell what he wrote, 9 different decisions were issued. Every single judge wrote a different decision, either concurring or dissenting. Nobody was together on any one opinion. That shows a lot of divisiveness on the court. What Taney wrote was, two parts to this decision. First, as to Dred Scott trying to sue for freedom, Dred Scott is not a citizen. And since he's not a citizen, he can't sue anybody for anything, freedom or whatever. And then he went on to explain why Dred Scott was not a citizen. If he'd said it's because he was a slave, that may have been consistent with the thinking of property and three-fifths compromise. But he went so far as to say because he was black, purposely implying that even free blacks were not citizens. He even defined that black people were not part of the original scheme of making up citizenship. The fact that there's an anomaly of 4% free doesn't change that fact. So, slave or free, if you were black, you were not a citizen of the United States. Therefore, you can't sue for freedom. Second part of the decision, as to the question of whether the Missouri Compromise can ban slavery there, or whether or not the Kansas-Nebraska Act has changed it to popular sovereignty, Taney takes the old argument that we were looking at in the Wilmot Proviso, takes the old Calhoun argument that you cannot deny people their property in the territories, that the Fifth Amendment rules. Therefore, what Taney's saying is you can never ban slavery in any territory until it becomes a state. Any previous banning of slavery in the territories violated the Fifth Amendment. Until it becomes a state. As long as it's a U.S. territory, people have the right to own slaves and territories. Only when it becomes a state and bans slavery as a state can it be banned. So it's a big, big victory for the pro-slavery forces and a big loss for the abolitionists. Finally, much later, Dred Scott is freed by the owner, but not right away. So when we talked about it to something of the first of the period, would a Dred Scott type case fly today? The first part of the decision? Why not? Oh, well, there's no slavery, obviously, but Dred Scott would be a citizen now, even if he was a slave. Why? Because he's born in this country. So what's really important is the 14th Amendment was drafted purposely to overturn Dred Scott. No court in the future could declare because of a given race, you're not a citizen if you were born here. So that's why the 14th Amendment was written that way. A debate we will not go into right now, but you can meditate over. There's a big movement going to say that we should do away with birthright citizenship, or at least make it be this way, that just being born here is not enough to be a citizen. Your parents have to also be citizens when you're born here. That's not what the 14th Amendment says, and you know where that's going. Yes? I think so, yeah. There's two reasons. One is when you abolish slavery in the 13th Amendment, that doesn't necessarily grant citizenship or equality. You're not a slave, but are you an equal citizen? Well, from Dred Scott, no. But the 14th eliminates the rest of Dred Scott. Well, Southerners were excited. Pro-slavery forces said, there you have it. The issue of slavery in the West is settled. You can't ban it. Northerners, especially Northern abolitionists, and especially Republican Party members, say, this is crazy. This is ludicrous. This is judicial activism gone wild. We'll fix this. We'll win the next presidential election and pack that court with enough judges to reverse that decision. To which Southerners say, and when you do, we're gone. So it was following the Dred Scott decision, Southerners were already dug in that if a Republican Northerner wins the presidential election, they're going to secede. Of course, as you know, Lincoln will, and they will secede. But to look at some Lincoln here, item 36. The last time we dealt with Lincoln, he had wanted to know, he had asked on what spot violence broke out in 1846 in the Mexican War, and looking unpatriotic, was not reelected to his congressional seat. But now in the late 1850s, he's back out of obscurity, seeking the presidency as a Republican. And the reason the Republican Party wanted him, was because he was not an extremist on slavery. He was a moderate. When asked about slavery, he said, where it currently exists, meaning southern states, we can do nothing about. That's established, that's property rights. Where it does not exist, western territories, we can stop. So obviously he opposed Red Scott. So he was opposed to its spread, but willing to tolerate its current existence. Now, if asked in his heart if he thought slavery was wrong, morally, ethically, etc., he'd say, yes, of course it is, but that's a decision that was made before I got here, so nothing I can do about that. If you watch the Lincoln attitudes, he's pretty ho-hum about slavery up until about the middle of the war, and then he begins to change and become really a crusader for abolishing slavery. The events of the war do that. But some say, even though his wife went insane, she worked a constant ethical pull on him, and that she's the one who had been anti-slavery from early years on and just pounded away at him all the time, that this war is a message from God to free slaves and you're the one that should be doing it. And so he may have moved in his attitudes because of Mary Todd. Anyway, one of the parts for getting him ready for the presidency is to run him for the Senate seat. In 1858, the Senate race. He's running against sitting Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, the popular sovereignty sponsor of Kansas-Nebraska. The two of them, Douglas, the Democrat, current seat holder, and Lincoln, the Republican challenger, been a Whig before, now he's a Republican, decide they will hold 7 different debates in 7 different cities for this Senate race, which kind of brings this question to mind. Until 1913, how were senators selected? Appointed by the state legislature. So why not just hold your debate at the state legislature and save all that other roadshow? Well, people do make a difference. People influence the legislature, but it could also be... Well, put it in another vein. You remember Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell? We won't spend too much time on this, but they got into that big fight over him. We talked about that. That Falwell made... Flint made fun of Falwell in Hustler magazine, and they got into a big legal fight over it. Well, after that fight was all over, they started making appearances on talk shows, Larry King Live and Geraldo Rivera and everything, and they would kind of go through a little fake sparring, and then they'd say that they respect each other and they're all God's children, etc. What were they doing? Using each other to spread their campaign. Falwell spreading the Christian right campaign, and Flint spreading this, I guess, secular humanist campaign, use that phrase. And they knew they needed each other for the publicity. This is Douglas and Lincoln. They're not just running for the Senate seat. They're doing what? Running for the presidency. And each time they hold a debate in a different city and the press covers it, it gets all over the wire service and into the back east publications. So they're really both using the Senate race to get their party to look at them as candidates. And it will work because the Republicans will nominate Lincoln and the Democrats will nominate Douglas in the 1860 election. So that 1860 election saw both major candidates running from the same state. Could that happen this year? You could say yes, Hillary and Giuliani, or you could say Hillary and Huckabee. New York, New York, Arkansas, Arkansas. Well, in the debates, mostly Lincoln bested Douglas. His seeming simple prairie wit was quite sharper than Douglas anticipated. And in one particular city, Freeport, town rather than city, at Freeport, Lincoln really nailed Douglas on a question. He said, do you still stand by and support the concept of popular sovereignty as a solution to slavery in the territories? And Douglas had to say yes. That was his big thing he'd been known for. So he said, yes, I think popular sovereignty is a workable solution. It's local, it's democratic, it's gradual. And then Lincoln said, well, do you support the recent Dred Scott decision, which says popular sovereignty doesn't matter, you just can't ban it? He said, yes, I support that also. He had to say that or he'd lose all the Southern support of the Democratic Party. He says, well, how do you reconcile the two when they're complete opposites? And the Douglas response, a weak one at that, was, he says, well, in practical fashion, it works like this. You bring slaves out there because you have the right to own slaves. But if they run off and nobody catches them, there's no police to catch them, then essentially they're free. You have popular sovereignty. That was the Douglas response to that. Well, that didn't impress Southern Democrats a bit. And so before they would give their support to him as a candidate, they started demanding that he recant popular sovereignty. And they also added, we want on our campaign pledge the creation of federal slave-catching police that will run through the territories catching all these runaway slaves. Douglas still won the Senate race. Lincoln did not. The reverse would be true in the presidential election 2 years later. Things don't slow down a bit in item 37, another incident involving John Brown, the sequel, he's back. John Brown has concluded that the only way to erase the sin of slavery and to make people pay for all the misery they had caused in the South was to foment a gigantic slave rebellion. Now, there were about four or five major slave rebellions that occurred. We only talked about one, the Nat Turner Rebellion. But Brown, who, white person, white religious leader, studies how these previous slave rebellions failed each time. And the major reason he found that they failed was that somebody on the inside of the planning turned on the plot, went to the big house, reported to the master, and that's how it was always stopped. So Brown told different people in different levels of leadership parts of the plan, but never the whole plan, so that when he gives the final marching orders, it'll be too late to go rat. Except he told his sons, because they were close family and been with him. But he was mean and rotten to the sons and pushed around and embarrassed them in front of others. So one of them, I don't remember the name, angry at how he'd been treated in front of others, went and told the Virginia militia that they were going to take over a federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry today sits in the state of West Virginia, near Wheeling, West Virginia, the capital. But then there was no West Virginia. So what was once a giant, large Virginia over there, this area where Harper's Ferry's arsenal was. As it turns out, militia forces get there in time and stop the takeover, led by Robert E. Lee. Brown's captured, arrested, placed on trial for treason. What Brown was thinking had he succeeded was you get the weapons in the darkness and depths of the midnight time period, you arm slaves in a nearby plantation who kill their masters and move to the next plantation, arm those slaves, kill those masters, and a wave of slave uprisings occur and the news is all cut off, and by the time people find out, you're already down into the Carolinas. He had plans for thousands and thousands of slave rebellions to all be following this thing, but of course it failed. And while on trial, he was not a bit repentant for what he'd done. He said that this nation's sin could only be cleansed in a bloodbath, and that if it wasn't the bloodbath he had tried to launch, it would have to be a civil war. Of course, he's predicting what happens a couple of years later. So he's executed. Which means in item 38... this is an election that's kind of charged emotionally. A lot of stuff been going on in the 1850s leading up to the 1860 election. Four candidates run for the presidency in 1860. The Democrats meet in Charleston, South Carolina. They chose that place on purpose, Deep South, hoping that the climate of the Deep South would pressure Douglas to recant his positions on popular sovereignty. He doesn't. He refuses to budge. Angry, half the Southern Democratic Party just bolts from the convention and leaves and goes over to Baltimore, where they hold a second convention and nominate a second candidate, the sitting Vice President John Breckinridge, who was a resident of Fort Smith at one time, too. So there's two Democrats running for president. Douglas from Illinois, Breckinridge from Kansas, the vice president. There's a third party appearance, a group who call themselves the Constitutional Union Party. Most of them were leftover know-nothings. since they lived in the border states that we've described, they kind of figured that's where most of the fighting is going to occur. So they said, we can take a break from hating Irish and keep this union together for a while. Their candidate was John Bell. Their catchy slogan, the Bell Ringers. Maybe it hit better then than now. Republicans, in their first presidential bid, no, second, sorry, because they ran one in 56 and lost, their second presidential bid in 1860, will nominate Lincoln. Again, most of this party had been anti-slavery. The nomination of Lincoln, who was a moderate on the issue, was really not only to get Western votes, but it was to get Eastern business votes in. Eastern businessmen were saying, we don't care that much about the slavery issue. We want tariffs and roads and banks, etc. And why should we join a party that's all up on the issues of slavery? Well, when they nominated Lincoln, they said, Lincoln is willing to accept it where it is. He won't run off the South. He won't cause secession. And the South will secede anyway when Lincoln wins. And it's really strange because Lincoln was a very, very moderate candidate who had not threatening views on the slavery issue. He was willing to let it exist. But the South ran off like they promised. If Republicans win, they'd leave. To some degree, not to waste too much time on this, it reminds me of how so many Republicans hated Bill Clinton and Hillary because they're the crazy leftist socialists. I'm a crazy leftist socialist. They weren't. They were a disappointment. And that's really the case with Lincoln, that he was not the radical abolitionist Southerners feared. They shouldn't have quit. I think that's true. There's a lot more than Lincoln. They could see the handwriting on the wall down the road that they're just going to get outpopulated, so why not get out when the getting's good? That's true. And using the Lincoln election and rallies and unites people, so that's an accurate assessment. We turn the page. Look at the top of the next page here in item 39. This is the Republican Party platform. They run on the issue of free homesteads. Part A, meaning that they will promise to give a land away free out west. Which element of the Republican Party are they trying to please here? Free soilers. They also promise the building of a transcontinental railroad. Who's being catered to now in the party? Well, still Western farmers who need that transportation to get their crops across, but also Eastern business persons who want to sell their wares. In item C, they propose a National Banking Act, which we'll explain later. It was the closest thing they could come up with, a new national bank that would regulate currency. Again, that is something that would please business persons back east. In item D, they advocated higher tariffs, a tariff increase. That's to please former business Whigs also. And in item E, they promised to, if they win, they will make sure there will be a ban on slavery in the territories. And of course, to do that, you've got to pack the court and change the decision. So when you look at all this, free homesteads, Transcontinental Railroad, National Banking Act, higher tariffs, and the ban on slavery. How many of these elements are going to win Southern votes? None of them. They clearly represent Northern and Western issues. And that's something in 1 through 11 we didn't talk about, but how politically the sections grew from a North-South into a Northwest versus a South. And you can see it in this campaign that the Republican Party does not represent any Southern wishes. Northern and Western. So if they do win, which they do, the presidency, again, what signal does that tell the South? That Northerners and Westerners can win every presidential election forever, and we can lose them forever, so why stay in this union? Well, as 40 says here, despite Lincoln's moderate stand on slavery, his victory triggers a string of Southern secession. South Carolina is the first to leave in 41, December of 1860. South Carolina will be the first. If you look at 41, all of these postal abbreviations, Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, which are a darker pumpkin color on our map here. These states all secede between December and April. Then Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, and Virginia will secede after the first fighting takes place at Fort Sumter. The Fort Sumter attack in Item 45 will cause those other states to join up. In Item 42, yes? The ones that are the darker colors here, Texas, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida, they secede between December and April. Arkansas, Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, they sit on the fence and wait till that fighting starts in Fort Sumter, and then they join up. And then we should add Missouri, Kentucky, West Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. Never leave. They're slave states and stay loyal. And what really happens is, as I said, there was no West Virginia. West Virginia comes into existence during the war.
Which ones never leave?
The darker brown ones. Missouri, Kentucky, West Virginia, which actually secedes from Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. So the Confederacy is formed in these first few months. Its capital's at Montgomery. Its president will be Jefferson Davis of Mississippi, who at one time had dated Mary Todd Lincoln. So had Stephen Douglas. She had dated Douglas, Davis, and Lincoln. And when asked about why she chose to date these politicians, she said, because I'm going to marry somebody that's going to be a president. And she was right. She dated two different presidents, the president of the Confederacy and the Union. The capital would later move to Richmond, Virginia, after Virginia joined the Confederacy. So Richmond's not that far from Washington, so both capitals are very close to each other. Let me do 43 and 44, and then we'll be done and ready to take the quiz over materials. Still leaving a lot of time to finish what we need for the final. Yes? Yeah, 42 is... Oh, I left out something. Glad you asked me. The capital of the Confederacy was first established at Montgomery, Alabama, would later move to Richmond, Virginia. The president of the CSA, Confederate States of America, was Jefferson Davis. Vice president, forgot to mention this guy, Alexander Hamilton Stevens, Alexander Stevens of Georgia. This is no value at all, what I'm getting ready to say. Out of the closet, well-known Jewish gay guy. Now, why do I say this? Trying to make it look like they're not a bunch of bigots. They may have seceded, but they're not that typical type of, you know, skinhead fanatic white supremacist that we see. If somebody of that stature could become vice president. Jefferson and Stevens hated each other. They put together a constitution real similar to the U.S. Constitution, the exception being states have the right to secede. And there are one-term, six-year presidencies. And slavery is a guaranteed right. Well, I want to do 44. 44 is real significant. It's a good one, too. Yeah, I can do 43 in a quick comment. I don't know if you need to know it for the test. Lincoln's, well, it makes sense. Lincoln's elected in November, but he's not going to take office until March, right? So in other words, during this period that Lincoln is a president-elect is when all these states are seceding. That would mean your lame duck president, Buchanan, should be doing something about this. This is where Buchanan gets ranked worst. Worst president in America is right here. Here's how he earns it. When asked, what does he think about these seceding states as president? Shouldn't he be pulling a Jackson or something, trying to invade them? And the Buchanan response is, if you look closely at the fourth article of the Constitution, it's illegal to secede. Since it's illegal to secede, they can't do it. And since they can't do it, they haven't done it. And since they haven't done it, I can't do anything about it. And then when pressed further, Lincoln will handle it later. That was how Buchanan. That's what's going on in item 43. Well, to step back just a little bit to December of 1860 in item 44. there is one last effort made to keep these southern states from leaving. Of course, we don't have Clay or Webster or Douglas, but we don't have Clay and Webster to do it. So a Kentucky politician, John J. Crittenden, offers to come up with a compromise. He proposes a compromise that if the southern states will not leave, or if those who have will come back, first, there'll be federal compensation for runaway slaves. Instead of trying to catch the slaves and bring them back, you just send us a bill showing that you truly had a slave that escaped and what it's worth, market value, and the federal government will cut your check. Just compensate them for runaway slaves. Second, a constitutional amendment guaranteeing that slavery can never be abolished where it exists unless the people of that state vote for it. So a permanent amendment guaranteeing slavery where it exists. Yeah, the second part of the Crittenden Compromise to get the South to come back was where slavery exists, it can never be banned unless the people of that state themselves vote for it. So they could never lose through a constitutional amendment that they didn't vote for. Third, extend the line, the 3630 line, out to California and just guarantee that forever this territory, as a territory and later as a state, will be slave territory. At least the slavery will be guaranteed out there. No slaves ever moved, and no slaves ever moved, but it's always going to be legal out there. Now, that, every bit of that is pro-South. It's a compromise to try to get those who are holding their breath and turning blue to come back. Who's leader of the Republican Party in a de facto sense after winning the election? Lincoln, right? Third one is extend that 3630 line from Panhandle, Texas out to California and just guarantee that in those territories, Arizona, New Mexico, that slavery will always be legal. Can't ban it. But here's the interesting part of this. Tells us something about Lincoln, and we'll get ready for the quiz right after this. Lincoln is willing to accept the compensation for runaway slaves. Lincoln is even willing to accept an amendment that protects slavery permanently. So the great emancipator, Lincoln, is willing to agree to a permanent division of slavery in the South. Those parts don't bother him. That shows how moderate he was. But he said the extension of the line is not what people voted for. Part E of the platform was we're going to ban slavery in the territories. We won this election. If you can secede and reverse elections, they mean nothing in the future. So we have to stand on the idea that we're not going to drop, that we're going to go for the ban on slavery out in the territories. And that is where the Crittenden Compromise fell apart and correspondingly war followed. So as we get ready for our quiz here, you have to ask yourself this question. Was a war like the Civil War fought over the imaginary Negro in the impossible place because Lincoln wouldn't budge on the compromise?